Begin our meeting with a little bit of business. First, with the introduction, as we are moving closer and closer to the deadline, you'll note that our bill introduction amounts are on the rise. And so you have, or should have, do you have in front of you, I hope, various LC drafts. So I will quickly move through these, and I'm going to be just reading the relating clauses on them, colleagues. If you want to stop and talk about any of them, bring it up by individual number, and we can talk about them. LC 2839 relating to criminal procedure, LC 2910 relating to criminal offenses, LC 2946 relating to corrections, LC 2947 relating to domestic relations, LC 2950 relating to motor vehicles, LC 2951 relating to crime, LC 2952 relating to juveniles, LC 2953 relating to crime, LC 2990 relating to public defense services and declaring an emergency, LC 3066 relating to attorney's fees, LC 3067 relating to damages, LC 3069 relating to criminal procedure, LC 3070 relating to the Oregon Youth Authority, LC 3071 relating to sentencing, LC 1569 relating to planned community association records, LC 3000 relating to public official ethics. Those are the LCs that are in front of us for introduction by the committee. Is there any discussion about any of those particular LCs? If you have specific information you want, you can certainly check in with the Judiciary Office. If you'll note, a lot of those relating clauses in and of themselves might explain the bills in their entirety. As is usual, the committee will give its standard notice to members that your support of these bills being introduced as committee bills in no way indicates either your support or opposition to the bills. With that being said, the chair would move the introduction of those LCs as committee bills. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bills are introduced as committee bills. Next up, we are going to reverse the agenda because I think it will be quick, and we can let Mr. Chamoff get back to doing the business he needs to do in the Legislative Council's office, which is get all us our bill drafts before the filing deadline on the 3rd of March. So the chair will open a hearing, a public hearing, on Senate Bill 81. And I'd ask Mr. Chamoff and anyone he's brought with him, if he's brought anyone at all, to come forward and remind the committee that there may be prizes if you're paying attention to this bill. Oh, on this bill? All right, hold on. Small technical change. We are going to open Senate Bill 81 for work session as opposed to public hearing. So please proceed, Mr. Chamoff, as invited testimony in a work session.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council, thank you very much for your prompt attention to this measure. If you need to explain to your colleagues why you're working Senate bills so early in the process, to the extent that we can get this bill through now and not have to amend it repeatedly later with conflict amendments, you will be doing your part to help protect the general fund. The revisers bill, unlike the controversial measures that we brought before you last time, does not make substantive changes in the law. Our crack editors go through and find archaic terms, places that are confusing, gender-specific terms when they ought not be, and we bundle these all together into one bill and present it to you for your approval by way of background. You have probably given me the authority to make most, if not all, of these changes without bringing the bill to you. However, we in the office believe that it's better for the government if any of the changes that are occurring in the laws of the state are handled by its elected officials rather than one selected by its elected officials. To encourage reading of the bill, we sprinkle throughout the explanatory notes non-standard descriptions of what it is we're doing in each of the provisions. And for a member lucky enough to have identified one of those non-standard notes, I have from the Schoolhouse Rock collection the I'm Just a Bill ink stamper. Now, I have to warn you that the ink in the stampers is dry. The last time I inked these four people beforehand, they came away with a great deal more ink than the stamper. So you'll just have to be satisfied with the stamper itself and applying your own ink. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be pleased to answer any questions or to award prizes.
Thank you, Mr. Chamoff. Okay, opening round, colleagues.
Door one.
Anybody got anything?
No.
Representative Sherrill.
I do. I want to, in the interest of full disclosure, I actually went through and marked up my bill last night with a few goodies, but then...
Obviously the nerd of the committee.
Courtesy of staff, Patsy actually provided me a something that she had done. I just want to call members' attention to a few, if I may,
you may
demonstrate what passes for entertainment and humorous writing in this. We have, for instance, on page 93, the note following section 134. Overhauls section to correct titles, punctuation and syntax, conforms to legislative style, beautifies ORS. I think that's a high calling, and not only do we deal with beauty, but we deal with another institution. An institution here on page 143, the note following section 216. Remarries, subject and verb. In sub 1. I think that's worthwhile, too. And I know I saw a futzes in here. I was glad to see that, Greg. Thank you for...
Yes, on page 30, colleagues of the bill, line 37, corrects official title in subsection 4 DC, futzes with syntax in section 11.
And, Mr. Chair, on page 257, at the end of section 390, it tweaks awkward syntax. So... I would encourage us for committee members to spend some time on this bill. And Mr. Chair, if I may, too, there is one, Greg, where I see that we are going down this dangerous road of eliminating gender-specific terms again. We did this a couple sessions ago where we did firemen,
yes.
As I recall. We had a bill that changed fireman to fireperson, and we were ready to move this until it was railroads folks that came up and said, no, that's not a gender-specific term. It's a term of art, and a fireman on a train is not a person who puts out a fire, but it is something else entirely, and we actually had to amend that bill back to put fireman back in the statute, as I recall, because there's no such thing as a fire person on a train. But having said that, Mr. Chair, I got no objections to the bill.
Anybody else? There is on page 251, tinkers with syntax. At some point I'll ask Mr. Chamoff to give us the difference between a futz and a tinker and a tweak. I am interested on page 281 of the bill, Council Chamoff, on line 18, corrects solecism in sub 9. I would certainly be interested in you explaining what that means.
Mr. Chair, members, a solecism is grammar that is highly unattractive, but not so unattractive as to be wrong.
That would account for most of my writing, Mr. And line 9 on page 280 revises a run-on sentence in sub 3. I like that one as well. That's also very descriptive of most of my writing style. Anything else, colleagues? We do have an amendment. Do you want to speak to the amendment, Mr. Chamoff?
Mr. Chair, members, we'd encourage you to pass the bill to the floor after incorporating the -1 amendment. I'm not sure what this says for the Department of Forestry, but session after session, the Department of Forestry is the one entity in state government that appears to read the bill carefully and find places where we could improve it. And in this instance, we had proposed deleting a reference to a 12-year-old study, and the Department of Forestry, ever vigilant, suggested that that study, despite its age, still had some utility, and so we have changed that section so that it retains the reference to the study. After we produced the bill, we found another place where we had referred to within 6 months after obtaining necessary waivers, and in fact those waivers were obtained, so the conditional language in that provision is now obsolete and come out. But that's the extent of the changes made by the Dash 1 amendments.
All right, colleagues. Any other questions, Mr. Chamoff, about the bill or the amendments? Okay, we are in work session. That's approved.
I move the approval of the Dash 1 amendments to this House bill.
Thank you. Representative Ackerman moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 8081. Is there any discussion on this motion? Is there any objection? The amendments are adopted. Representative Ackerman?
I move that Senate Bill 81 be moved to the House floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves Senate Bill 81 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, would you call the roll, Ann?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kuzanski?
Aye.
Representative Cheverly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 81 is amended. We'll move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It is a great honor of the Judiciary Committee to carry the revisers bill to the floor each session. I'm looking for a member who would like to have the honor of carrying that bill. I think it might be appropriate that...
Chair.
You think the chair?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think Representative Ackerman might. Would you be interested in carrying the bill, Representative Ackerman?
I
think you can, too. All right. We'll assign Senate Bill 81 to Representative Ackerman to carry on the floor. You're also a member of the Legislative Council Committee, so that'll put you in good stead. All right.
Five more votes.
Five more votes.
Thank you for the honor.
Yeah, you're very welcome. We are going to ask you what a solecism is, Representative Ackerman, so you need to be prepared.
I'm prepared.
All right, we are going to open a public hearing now on House Bill 2526. And we're going to start with Representative Lane Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll ask Tom Ewing to join me. Tom is the Chief Hearing Officer of the Hearing Officer Panel and will follow me in my testimony. Before you today is House Bill 2526. Those of you who were in the legislature 4 years ago will perhaps recall House Bill 2525 that created the Central Hearing Officer Panel, and it was just a matter of fortuitous timing that we filed, House Bill 2525 created the panel, and it created it for a four-year pilot project phase with a sunset. That sunset was extended during the third special session. But only to the end of this biennium, the coming biennium. And so we have the matter before us to repeal the sunset on the hearing officer panel and make it permanent in some of the other changes that are before you in this bill. It was a matter of fortuitous timing that that this bill was filed at a point in time where we were able to achieve a bill number of House Bill 2526, And so I'm able to tell you that this is just one better than House Bill 2525, which created the panel in the first place. This bill comes to you from the Hearing Officer Panel Oversight Committee that was created under House Bill 2525 and has been monitoring the implementation of the Hearing Officer Panel since its inception. The Hearing Officer Panel Oversight Committee consists of two members appointed by the Speaker, two members appointed by the Senate President, two representatives from the Department of Justice, two representatives from the private bar representing clients before administrative agencies, and Mr. Ewing sits as an ex officio member in his capacity as the Chief Hearing Officer. For those of you who were not here in 1999, I'll just give you the quick summary of House Bill 2525. It actually was the culmination of about 20 years worth of on and off efforts to create an independent hearing officer panel for the conduct of contested case proceedings before state agencies. In 1997, actually, the legislature passed House Bill 2948, which would have created the Office of Administrative Hearings as a standalone agency to conduct contested case proceedings for a defined group of state agencies. That bill was well received by the legislature in 1997, but was vetoed by the governor following the 1997 session. But the governor recognized, I think, a strong legislative interest in moving in this direction, as more than half the states have done, and so convened a working group in the interim following the 1997 session that included Department of Justice and agency representation, as well as representation from the private bar, again, and his office on this working group. And that working group then put together and introduced ultimately House Bill 2525 in 1999 at the request of Governor Kitzhaber. And unlike the bill that preceded it, which had identified a certain group of agencies that would be in, basically the governor's edict was, well, if we're going to go that direction, let's go that direction. And the direction of the bill was substantially reversed, and basically it includes almost all state agencies, boards, and commissions with a list of exceptions, as opposed to the previous bill that included, that had a list of agencies, boards, and commissions that would be included. House Bill 2525 created a central hearing officer panel that conducts hearings for most agencies, boards, and commissions of the state. In the previous system, the typical scenario that we heard in hearings on House Bill 2525 was that of an agency largely functioning as prosecutor, judge, and jury of enforcement actions against citizens and businesses and taxpayers, professionals, and other people who were subject to the regulatory authority of the agency, and a question about both the appearance and, in fact, the substance of fairness, where you have an agency that initiates an enforcement action and then itself conducts the hearing and makes the final determination in the case. House Bill 2525, in creating the Office of the Central Hearing Officer Panel, attached the panel to the Department of the Employment Department, where it is today. And Tom can tell you the volume of cases. I think it's over 30,000.
That's correct.
Over 30,000 cases now annually that the panel is conducting. And we have gone, I think, just we have made tremendous strides towards achieving fairness, not only the appearance of fairness now, and having removed the hearings function from the agencies, boards, and commissions, but I think we have also taken great strides in achieving fairness in fact in the way state governments, state government agencies relate to those that are subject to the regulation of the agencies. I'll just mention to you what we have in what I have in my packet, and then I'll turn it over to Tom. Tom tells the story of the panel very well and very passionately for those of you who have heard him. House Bill 2526 is a big bill, but what it does is really fairly narrow. In Section 1, it changes the title of the Chief Hearing Officer to Chief Administrative Law Judge. It changes the name Hearing Officer Panel to Office of Administrative Hearings. And then throughout the bill, you will also see the change in the designation of hearing officers to administrative law judges. Section 3 of the bill maintains the Office of Administrative Hearings in the Employment Department with the Chief Administrative Law Judge appointed by the director, but it also provides the director would consult with and consider recommendations from the Oversight Committee in making the appointment of the Chief Administrative Law Judge. That was actually a suggestion made by Debbie Lincoln, director of the Employment Department, and I think endorsed enthusiastically by the Oversight Committee, recognizing that we have this central panel housed within an agency, and we think it's important to try to maintain some effort to protect the independence of the Chief Administrative Law Judge and the panel, even from its very gracious host agency. Section 3 also provides for the appointment of the Chief ALJ for a term of 4 years. That also is intended to provide operational independence for the Chief Administrative Law Judge, so they that person would be unlike just another section head of the agency. For a term of 4 years, terminable during the term for cause. There's language in the bill that would be changed by the Dash 2 amendments that define the extent of cause for the purpose of termination. That language comes from the governor's office, and I think there is a letter with the materials that you have in your desk, too, from the governor's office that addresses this point, and I support the Dash 2 amendments as being consistent with the direction of the Oversight Committee. Section 20 is, Tom can speak to this, it authorizes the Chief Administrative Law Judge to employ student law clerks on a temporary basis, and then most importantly, Section 21 repeals the sunset on the panel and makes it permanent. I'll take just another minute to walk you through what the packet contains. It has underneath the summary excerpts of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee review of the hearing officer panel that was done last year. As you might expect, this was something of a less in-depth review than JLAC might have done if we'd not had five special sessions going on during the course of this investigation. But nevertheless, I turn your attention to the recommendations that appear at the bottom of what is the second page of the report in your materials. It's page 11 of the report, and a clear recommendation that the that this legislature repeal the sunset provision on the hearing officer panel. And then, if you recall, in the special session, House Bill 4035 was passed that recommended review of considerations and questions that are set forth on page 12. And that really is a function of ongoing review, which agencies should be required to use the panel. Should it continue as part of another agency, or should it become a standalone agency? Those questions are set forth in the materials recommended for consideration by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. Under House Bill 2526, the oversight committee that is currently in place over the panel will continue, and I would suggest that those are entirely appropriate considerations for the hearing officer the oversight committee to continue to deal with as we move forward with the panel on a permanent basis. The next part of the materials is just something that I included for your edification. It's a long, long law review article that I've excerpted here by our very own Dave Hendricks. Dave was very much a player in the creation of House Bill 2525, and after the 1999 session wrote an excellent law review article for Willamette Law Review that not only explains the bill and the structure of the panel, but also gives sort of a fly-on-the-wall kind of rendition of how the bill came to be. And for those of you who were not here in 99, this will give you the excerpts that I have attached in my materials, give you a sense of what we went through to get it, and it may just interest you in taking a look at the larger article. I think I would call your attention to page 221 of the article just to give you a sense of where we are coming from with House Bill 2525 and what it represents in terms of the change, the major change in policy for Oregon when we established it in 1999. On page 221, reading from David's article, House Bill 2525 was not an average bill, nor was the process by which it became law typical of the procedure by which most bills become law, but the history of House Bill 2525 could serve as a model for the process by which proposals for major changes in basic laws should be considered. Dedicated and knowledgeable people carefully scrutinized the bill's language. The participants worked in good faith to formulate policies that best advanced the interests of the people of the state of Oregon as each of those participants perceived those interests. They identified points of significant dispute early, and their discussions focused on those points. They compromised. The process resulted in a product that all of the participants supported. I'm pleased to say that House Bill 2526 that comes to you has substantially the same level, I would say has the same level of support. You'll hear from Phil Schradl of the Department of Justice on the bill today. Again, the governor's office is on board with the amendment made in the definition of cause for the purpose of termination of the chief administrative law judge. The private bar supports this, and I commend it to this committee for its consideration and passage today. I will tell you that as drafted, this bill was very carefully and narrowly drafted so as to avoid a fiscal impact. In fact, at this point, to unbundle the Central Hearing Officer panel and to revert the hearing officers back to the agencies from which they came to establish the panel would have a fiscal impact. And so I think we are driven in a direction here to make the panel permanent, not just by good policy, but happily good policy that also coincides with the fiscal restraint that we are operating under in this session. I think the last thing, because I don't want to leave it, but it's not a major element of the bill, but we do change the title of hearing officer to administrative law judge, and that I would just address. I think Tom may touch on that as well. We have administrative law judges in other functions in the state, in the Workers' Compensation Division. PUC has its own administrative law judge section. Those agencies are not within the panel, but those people perform substantially the same service and role in the office of in the hearing officer panel. So this is an effort to harmonize those the name by which we call those functions in statute, and also it brings it into conformance with other states and federal agencies that also have hearing officers who are referred to as administrative law judges. And so in that respect, I think we are just bringing ourselves into conformity with not only other agencies of the state, but also other parts of government in other states and at the federal level that use that title. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I may just defer. You may wish to hear from Mr. Ewing first.
Any questions for Representative Shetterly before we hear from Mr. Ewing? Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Representative Shetterly. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you about the hearing officer panel. I'll advise you that I can talk for hours and hours and hours about this. I promise, however, sir, only 15 minutes.
There you go.
There are four things I'd like to talk to you about. First is the mission of the hearing officer panel. Secondly, who we are, what we do. Thirdly, what we've accomplished in the last 3 years. And finally, the cost efficiencies that I think the panel has shown. Some of the things I'll be talking about have already been covered by Representative Shetterly, but with your permission, I'll maybe restate them again. Let me begin with the mission of the hearing officer panel, and that mission can be stated easily enough. We are here to provide a level playing field for citizens and for businesses in their disputes with state agencies. And to state it differently, and to coin a phrase from Representative Shetterly, no agency should be both the policeman, the prosecutor, the judge and the jury in its own action. Let me put this in context for you. If the Department of Agriculture proposes to assess a $10,000 fine against a farmer for the alleged misapplication of a pesticide, and that farmer protests, that farmer ought not to come into the hearing room and be judged by an employee of the Department of Agriculture. If a health licensing board wishes to revoke a license of a physician and she protests, she ought not come into a hearing room to find her case judged by members of the board that want to take this very action against her, represented by an assistant attorney general there to persuade the board to do what the board wants to do anyway. There's got to be a better way, and in 1999, you ladies and gentlemen found it with the passage of House Bill 2525 and the creation of the hearing officer panel. And in doing so, you joined 21 other states that have central panels themselves. Let me just say, by parenthetically, I received an email yesterday that as we speak, your counterparts in the state of Arkansas are also considering the creation of a central panel. Let me turn to who we are and what we do. We have been operational since January 1, 2000. We are the consolidation of 7 formerly independent and separate agency hearing units. If you will look at Exhibit A, you will note that those in bold and capitalized are the agencies which transferred both hearing officers and operational staff to the panel. I'll explain the rest of the exhibit in a second. We have about 135 employees. We hear the cases for approximately 70 agencies. Excuse me. All of those agencies are listed here in Exhibit A. This represents about 90% of all state agency hearings. In the year 2002 alone, we heard 37,400 cases. And the range of the cases we hear, the range of our subject matter is enormous, one of the largest in the nation, by the way. We hear cases involving temporary assistance to needy families, the Oregon Health Plan, workers' compensation, a thin slice of it, unemployment insurance, disputes between homeowners and contractors, liquor licenses, drunken driving, all the professional licensing boards, such as the Board of Medical Examiners, chiropractors, nurses, and my favorite, the Board of Tattoo Artists. I will tell you that I have been fascinated to see how many boards and commissions there are on such a diverse number of professions. Turning to our accomplishments, when I read House Bill 2525, and when I speak with Representative Shetterly and others who helped design this bill, I came to realize 3 years ago that the purpose of the bill was not simply independence and impartiality, and that's fundamentally what the panel is about. But it's about more. It's about professionalizing a core of administrative law judges. We have done a lot in the last 3 years, and I'm very proud of what we've accomplished. Let me begin with hiring. Our hiring standards from day one became far more rigorous than what they were before. And indeed, what we had done was that we had instituted a rather unique screening device to ensure that we only got the best and the brightest of hearing officers. That screening device has been far more effective than I thought. I have not regretted anybody we have hired. And indeed, 2 other state central panels are now adopting that for themselves. And indeed, the General Counsel Division of the Department of Justice here in Oregon has expressed an interest in using it. Training. Previously, and to my shock, candidly, when I took this job, I discovered that hearing officers were not provided any training in the general principles of administrative law, and that was law that they were applying on a daily basis. That has changed. I also saw that agencies for their particular subject matters would train 5, 8, even more days with binders that thick, for the record, 4 inches wide. We have totally redesigned and rethought the way that we train. We have brought it down from 5, 8, and more days to 1 day with a binder that thick, 1 inch. The training is far more effective, and it makes us able to respond better and more professionally to address fluctuating caseloads. Legal resources. Again, to my shock, when I took this job, I discovered that a number of administrative law judges had no access at all to legal resources, and I'm thinking particularly decisions of the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. And I was horrified. That has changed. Today they all have access to that. And quality. Quality, perhaps, is an issue that I have spent more time on than anything else. When I took this job, I began reading all of our proposed orders. And for the last 2.5 years, I've read each and every one. In an early day, some of our proposed orders were fine. Others were, I will tell you, were questionable. And I knew that that was something that had to be addressed, and we did address it, and we redesigned the training program for those hearing officers doing proposed orders. The quality of our proposed orders has improved so enormously that I have stopped reading them. And for me, personally, that is my clearest evidence of my confidence in the work. And indeed, that particular training program that we implemented to improve the quality of our work again is being looked at by a couple of other central panels. I was invited not too long ago to give a presentation to my counterparts from other states. So there's great interest in what we have done, improved far beyond what I had expected. And we're applying the same techniques, same training techniques for our final orders, which is the bulk of what we do. I think that the improvement will come more slowly, but I'm beginning to see improvement already. Let me conclude with maybe the most important part of my presentation today. It might not have been that important 2 years ago, but it certainly is important today in view of the budgetary climate that we are all operating under, and that's the cost efficiencies of the hearing officer panel. That is, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is Exhibit B in your packet that you have before you. When we began life on January 1, 2000, our world did not look the same as it did on December 31, 1999. Two things changed. First of all, we began on January 1, 2000 with 5 fewer FTE positions handling hearings than were there doing hearings on December 31. 2 were managers who did not come to the panel, and 2 were hearing officers. That is an efficiency savings of about $900,000. Now, let me briefly explain how I come by these numbers. The numbers I have chosen are salary plus benefits. I have not included services and supplies. The employment department, for example, reckons that for every FTE, they figure 20% of the basic salary, the base salary, to be services and supplies. To my mind, that's a squishy number, and I'm trying to give you the most conservative number that I can rely upon. So I see a cost of savings there of $900,000. But the second thing changed on January 1, 2000. We took on an additional 60 agencies that we did not have before. That computes to about 3.5 FTE worth of work. Let me also explain how I come by an FTE calculation. We bill for services, not unlike the Department of Justice. We translate that billing into hours. Those hours are translated into FTE time. Those are hard numbers. Something else has changed, actually, in the last couple of years. With the recession, the number of our cases, case referrals, has increased by 24%, from about 30,000 to currently 37,000 in this last year. And we have been able to, for the most part, absorb that within the hearing officer panel. And in a moment, I'll explain to you how we have. Certainly, we have not, in the last 2-3 years, increased or asked for an additional FTE at all. One of the things that I looked at recently, now that we have 3 years of data, is the average hours per referral per hearing officer. That is to say differently, how many hours on average does a hearing officer spend on a referral? In the year 2000, that was about slightly over 4 hours per referral. In the year 2001, it was reduced. It fell to about 3.8. In this last year, 2002, it's slightly over 3.5 hours. Now, those are real savings. That's an efficiency improvement of about 11%, but it also translates into real dollars. And to try to calculate those dollars, what I did was that I looked at between 2000 and 2002 the actual costs of the panel, divided that by the number of referrals. In the year 2000, the average cost of a referral was about $292. In the year 2002, it dropped to $277. That's a savings of $15. Now, you may say, Ewing, $15 is not a lot. But if you multiply that times 37,400 referrals, it does become a lot of money. I calculate about $560,000 for the year 2002 alone. If you biennialize that, it would be something over $1 million, 1.1 plus. I will tell you also that we are under budget, I project, by the end of this biennium, by $1.6 million. This is $1.6 million less than agencies had budgeted for hearings. I expect and have offered up, although I did so with some understandable shudder, 8 to 10 FTEs that we will eliminate in the next biennium. Now, how were we able to do this? I will tell you that, for one thing, we have looked as a management team for every efficiency that we can get. But I have to tell you honestly, that has not really, the real answer for the efficiencies is something beyond my control. I believe that separate, distinct hearing units are inherently inefficient. And the reason is a very simple one. There is never a precise equation between the person to do the job and the work to be done. Let me give you an example, and if you will look at Water Resources Department. The Water Resources Department came to us on January 1 with one hearing officer, but they did not have one hearing officer's worth of work. They had 0.33, I think, worth of work. Now, I was advised about that back in late 1999. The Water Resources Department quietly advised me that they, frankly, had a hearing officer didn't have enough work to do. So 75 or 70% of her time was, to some extent, I guess, twiddling her thumbs. We were able to bring her in. We lost a couple of hearing officers to do social services cases. That's what she did, including Water Resources. That was a savings to Water Resources because we did not bill. We billed only for work performed on behalf of the department, a savings of, what, $108,000 or so over a biennium. But that's not all for Water Resources. Since 2001, we have taken on the Klamath Basin water rights litigation. It's probably the mother of all contested case litigation that I have ever seen. We've been spending about 1.75 FTE worth of work. We've been able to take that. That's being handled by two gentlemen, Bill Young and Skip Russell. We've been able to absorb that work, with that, again, without hiring anybody to do it. Water Resources would probably have had to hire two people in order to meet the need and would then have had overcapacity. Second example, Department of Consumer and Business Services. On January 1, they transferred six FTE to us, six people. They had, however, only 3.75 worth of work. Now, you may say, why would they have six people and 3.75 worth of work? This is something I know from my own experience. I was with the Department of Justice and did premium audit cases, tried them on behalf of Safe Corporation. And at one time, the premium audit litigation just skyrocketed, did so for two or three or four years, and DCBS appropriately staffed up for it. But then it declined remarkably. And agencies, as you may know, and it's understandable, are kind of loath to eliminate FTEs. So they kept the FTEs and had them doing other things besides hearings. We brought them in, and we were able to use them efficiently and effectively to handle all of these boards and commission cases that came to us on January 1. This was a savings to DCBS that they have not had to incur in this last biennium of about $360,000. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission is another example. It came to us with four FTEs, 3.3, however, worth of work. And so what we did was that we transferred one of the hearing officers to do division of child support cases, where we had developed a backlog because we had moved some of the DCS hearing officers to do unemployment insurance, which had skyrocketed. I'm pleased to report to you that that backlog in DCS has now been taken care of. So that's been a savings to Oregon Liquor Control Commission of about $112,000. There are other efficiencies. I won't go through them. They're here in my materials. They're less, but they're examples. I presented them to you as examples of our continuing effort to try to find every efficiency we can in the panel. Mr. Chairman, let me conclude with this. I've had the privilege of testifying to some of you in the past. And one of the things you've heard me say at the conclusion of each of my presentations is that I deeply believe that House Bill 2525 is not simply about good government. I think it's about best government. I think the same about House Bill 2526. But I'll add one more thing that I haven't said in the past. Not simply best government, but I think the hearing officer panel represents very, very efficient government. So with that, I conclude my remarks. Thank you very much for your patience, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ewing. Are there questions for either Representative Shetterly or Mr. Ewing about the hearings officer panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you for your comments about the efficiencies gained by the system. It might be helpful to hear just a little bit more elaboration about the quality of decisions that are made, and particularly in view of the greater independence that the members of the hearings officer panel have as compared to administrative law judges who are more directly connected with their individual constituent agencies.
Quality of the decisions. I will tell you that the experience of the hearing officer panel has been that the quality of the writing, the quality of the analysis, particularly in our proposed orders, as I have already indicated, has improved enormously. If the question is, do I know whether agencies win more or win less since the panel was created, which I think is an important question for you to ask, I don't know, and the reason is simple. When I took this job back in 1999, one of the first things I did was that I went out to a number of agencies to find out what kind of information, what data did they have on who won, who lost, how much did the hearing cost. I wanted to get as much base information because I knew, ladies and gentlemen, that this year you would be asking for that. Gentlemen, excuse me. I suddenly look around. I apologize, Mr. Chairman and members. I don't have that data.
Sorry, Representative Trimble isn't here.
So. Oh. I won't touch that, sir. I don't have that information. I wanted to get it, and to my surprise, agencies just didn't keep it. So I can't give you sort of a comparative impression.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Maybe just a general sense or comment, and I think maybe I was hearing it already, that the quality of the work product, in your view, is good but improved. But I'm wondering about maybe just a general sense about the extent to which there's greater independence achieved from the individual, agencies as a result of this configuration.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I was briefly an administrative law judge in one of the hearings units that's now part of the panel, and then I became its hearings unit manager. I can tell you that as an ALJ, I'll tell you this directly, that I was under pressure, distinct pressure, to change my opinion if I found against the agency. Now, fortunately, I had a very good boss who refused to allow that to happen, and I was the same boss when I took that position. That does not happen with the panel. And that has brought me, frankly, under some criticism from boards, I won't mention them, but that has brought me under criticism from boards who believe that the system ought to be as they were used to, and that is a closer relationship between the board and the hearing officer. I have refused to do it, and I've come under criticism for that because that strikes me as a form of collusion. Although for the best of intentions, and I'm not challenging the intentions of the board, of any of these boards, but today we try to be as analytical as we can to produce the very best decisions, but decisions that are, and I won't compromise on this, that are independent and impartial.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just in further to Representative McPherson's question, you don't see it in this bill, but in House Bill 2525, we created a structure in there to deal with ex parte contacts that substantially limits the ability of agency personnel to have ex parte contacts with the hearing officer. And that was an intentional firewall to limit the ability of the agency to influence the hearing officer. And in fact, I think it's working very well. Yes, from everything that I have heard. It requires disclosure of any ex parte contacts with an opportunity to respond. And that was, I think, one of the central elements of House Bill 2525, so you didn't have that opportunity for that private conversation between the someone from the director's office or somewhere else in the agency and that hearing officer after the hearing or before the hearing, for that matter. And that's a very important element of House Bill 2525. You won't see it in here since it's already embedded in the panel, but still a very important function of how the panel works.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Posansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to just follow up with what I think part of what Representative McPherson may have been asking. We've now had this board or panel together for 4 years. Do you have any numbers as to the number of appeals or challenges to orders that are being given out and if those have been successful? Maybe too early as to any type of documentation as it may compare to what has happened prior to your time, knowing that you have more of a baseline to look at as compared to what's happened since the this board or panel has really gone into effect.
Representative Williams, Representative Brzezinski, thank you very much for the question again. I don't have that information. The number of cases in the area of proposed orders, the number of cases that go on appeal to the Court of Appeals is relatively small, very small, and only now are we beginning to see them trickle through the system. So it hasn't really been 4 years. 4 years, it's been 3 years, and we're only tracking those that came to us on January 1, 2000, not cases that we inherited. So I do not have that information for you. But it is information that we will be we are tracking, and perhaps in the next biennium I can come back or next session and give you more information on that.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, a question. I've had professional experience with the hearings officers, and it's always been extremely satisfactory. Just a general question I have is: who handles the scheduling of the of the hearings? Is that something that's done by the panel staff, or is that done by the individual agency?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, overwhelmingly it is done by, in those high-volume cases, unemployment insurance, implied consent, where we were doing handling thousands upon thousands upon thousands, we do them. The answer is more complex with the smaller licensing boards and commissions that you may be familiar with. Some of the licensing boards and commissions like to do the scheduling themselves. Others have asked us to do that. Now, frankly, I don't like that system, and I'm going to be, as we look at the next biennium and as I begin negotiating and executing interagency agreements, I want to bring more consistency there because I think it's a process improvement that needs to be made. Either we do them all or they do them all. But it's a mixed bag. Some do them, some don't.
I just want to state for the record my overall experience in the scheduling is very, very difficult sometimes because there's multi clients, could be several witnesses in different locales. I just want to state for the record my experience has been very, very satisfactory. Whomever is doing this work, the scheduling is always timely, the accommodations are made. And I think what's very, very important from an efficiency standpoint with respect to participants in the process is the willingness of the hearings officers to conduct hearings by telephone conference call, where I can be in my office with my client in Eugene. We might have a witness in Cottage Grove and the hearings officers in Salem. And you've developed a very skilled process of handling those to make record complete and yet to make the process very expedient. I think that's part of your infrastructure efficiencies that maybe doesn't always get noted, but I wanted to put that on the record for you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may just respond. I had a client myself who had a I didn't represent this client. It was another office. But she had a case that went before the hearing officer panel and actually was caught off guard by how quickly the case was scheduled. And, in fact, I think she was going to be in Hawaii when the case was scheduled and wanted to continue it. And the contact she had with the hearing officer panel was one of accommodation that, yeah, if you're not going to be available, we can do that. But we can do this by telephone, and if we'd really like to keep these cases moving along, and they actually encouraged her not to reschedule but to keep the case going forward, which she did, and she was able to do it from the beach in Hawaii. Not a bad way to...
Yeah, just all phone in. Any other questions for this panel? Good. Thank you very much, John.
Mr. Chairman, may I say one more thing for the record? I promise to put something on the record, if
you
I may. Just
okay.
Take a second. With regard to the law clerks, you'll see that there is a provision in there authorizing me to hire law clerks. The SEIU has expressed some understandable concern as to what is the purpose behind that, and we've agreed that I would just explain to you, you gentlemen, that the purpose is one of efficiency, to hire one or two law clerks to help with legal research instead of having a hearing officer do it at their salary, to have a law clerk do it at a much cheaper salary. So that's the purpose of it. I'm expecting only one to two. I've now discharged my duty to SEIU.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, why don't we bring the folks up in pairs. Let's have Diana Godwin and Janice Krem, if they could come up together.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Diana Godwin. I'm an attorney in private practice from Portland, Oregon, and with me today is Janice Krem, also a private practitioner attorney from Portland. And what we have here in this room is Janice Krem, our past chair of the administrative law section of the bar, our current chair of the administrative law section of the bar, Representative Shetterly, and I am the chair-elect for next year. So it's, yes, it is. And we thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to testify today. We are here principally to testify in support of House Bill 2526. As last session, the administrative law section of the bar was instrumental, not last section, 1999, instrumental in supporting House Bill 2525. We have followed its work very closely. The administrative law section of the bar is comprised of about 240 members who volunteer to be members of the section. We have a full cross-section of attorneys representing governments, Department of Justice, private practitioners, and our executive committee reflects a balance of attorneys representing both government and private parties. You got a little bit of the flavor of administrative law from the viewpoint of those of us who are private practitioners, and you as legislators must understand, too, that state agencies, boards, and commissions have tremendous power to affect the lives and livelihoods of Oregon citizens. You had a few examples, a physician who has gone to school for years and may have been practiced for years may be at risk to lose his or her medical license. The process for making that determination is a very, very important one. And it's very important that the agency feel that it has a fair forum and that obviously the doctor whose license may be revoked also feels that the forum is fair and impartial. And that's what we think the hearings officer panel has gone a long way toward providing, a fair and impartial forum for those important decisions. You had the other example of a farmer who may be facing a tremendous financial fine for violation of the rules of the Department of Agriculture. I represent some plumbing contractors who could lose their ability to do business, depending on their ability to appropriately defend against charges. And you understand, I mean, when this happens and an agency brings a charge or proposes to revoke a license or proposes to impose an enormous fine, that the person asks for a contested case hearing, it's assigned now, fortunately, to an impartial hearings officer who takes the facts on the record, develops a record of testimony, documents, gives the parties, the agency, and the person that the agency is bringing an enforcement action against an opportunity to present all their evidence on the record. The hearings officer draws up a set of findings of fact based on what is in the record and a proposed order. In most cases, our hearings officers don't make the final decision, but submit a proposed order to the agency, which most agencies have reserved to themselves the ability to make the final decision based on the record that's developed by the parties and the hearings officer and based on the hearings officer's proposed order, findings of fact, and conclusions of law relating the facts as they were put on the record to the law that applies in a particular case. The Department of Agriculture's rules with respect to which pesticides are allowable in what amounts. Those rules govern then the, you know, the outcome of the hearing depending on what the facts are and whether the facts show that they did or did not violate that rule. So the hearings officer role is very important. And in the same spirit that we come today to vigorously and unreservedly support House Bill 2526, this bill, it's very important it move forward, and I understand the need for it to move forward unencumbered by substantial amendments. But we want to take this opportunity today to talk about some other concepts of administrative law as further suggestions for law improvement. And I have put these into written testimony, and the concepts that we want to talk about briefly are incorporated in House Bill 2058, which is a bill that is sponsored by the Administrative Law Section and that has been referred to your committee, but I understand the committee efficiencies may be that this is our time to talk briefly about those concepts because we may or may not have later opportunities. We want to commend a couple of additional concepts that we need to think about as we move forward in improving administrative law in this state. Again, getting back to my remark that for many citizens, their contact with state government is through state agencies, and how good or how bad that contact is affects how citizens feel about their government. And that's reflected in a lot of different ways, so I think it's very important. We would suggest that a couple of law improvement items we want to keep our eye on as we move forward, maybe this session, maybe next session, is to amend ORS 183, which is Oregon's Administrative Procedures Act, 183.425, to give a hearings officer and the agency the discretion to allow a party to take a deposition of a material witness. Let's go back to our example of a medical doctor who has been brought up on charges before the medical board, and the medical board is proposing to revoke her license to practice medicine. That's a very important issue. Right now, it is solely within the discretion of a state agency as to whether or not that doctor and her legal counsel, hopefully she has legal counsel in a matter like this, as to whether they get to take a deposition prior to the hearing to determine what are the facts that are being alleged against her, what are the charges, who's making them, are they credible. In most civil litigation, we know we have full discovery, rights of, to take depositions, so that when we go into trial, it's not a trial by ambush, it's a trial by fact, that everybody knows what the issues are going to be and what the evidence, hopefully, is going to be. That's why you take depositions, that's why you do discovery. In administrative law hearings, that's not the case. And right now, only the agency that's initiating the charges has the right to decide the scope and extent of discovery, including depositions, and whether or not the person against whom charges are being brought or a penalty sought, whether they get any discovery. The agency has the right, and they exercise it, to ask for discovery from you, the person against whom they're bringing charges. But it doesn't go both ways. Now, most agencies allow it, and that's good. Those are good practices. But we think the law should clearly reflect that those discovery rights are available to both sides. We'd like, again, to level the discovery playing field by requiring an agency to disclose information on their record that they plan to present at the hearing, just as they have today the right to ask it of a party against whom they are bringing charges. Getting back, I think, Ms., to one of the questions about scheduling, we'd like to add a new section to Oregon's APA that specifies the authority and responsibility of a hearings officer to conduct the contested case hearing from the time a request is filed right up to the issuance of the proposed order. The agencies have kept some of this to themselves, and we think that it would be more efficient for a hearings officer to be responsible for the following issues in a contested case: person's right to the hearing, the timeliness of their request for hearing, the adequacy of the agency notice, the hearing request, the scope of the hearing, discovery requests, requests for postponements or continuances, requests for consolidation or bifurcation of cases for hearing, party status, that is, who is effectively a party to the hearing, and the scope of participation for a limited party. Currently, the Attorney General's model rules governing hearings conducted by HOP hearing officers give the agencies extensive control over many of these procedural issues. We think that ought to be changed. And we'd also recommend that the procedural rules for hearings conducted by the HOP be revised in style and content to be more user-friendly and even-handed in their application to hearing participants. We think the rules currently are too complex with too many procedural hurdles for unrepresented parties and agency staff. It's okay for lawyers, but remember, many people come before state agencies without lawyers. And again, that forms their impression of the fairness of state government. It's very important that they feel that they can understand what's going to happen, and that the rules are not so complex that they have to hire an attorney. Ex-party contacts. This is probably going to be one of the more controversial. I want to follow up with Representative Shetterly's very nice lead-in, that's our segue, about the fact that in House Bill 2525 in Section 20, we put in some good procedures for disclosure of ex-party contacts when somebody says to a hearings officer, I saw Joe applying that pesticide, you know, when he shouldn't have, and I saw it was a 5-gallon barrel, and he says that privately, not on the record. It's not a fact. And the other party, Joe and his lawyer, aren't aware that that piece of information is being communicated off the record and in private. So in House Bill 2525, a hearing officer from the HOP who receives such an oral or written off-the-record or ex-party communication must follow specific and detailed provisions for putting that communication on the record so that all parties are aware of it, and if they want to bring in evidence to refute that, they're able to, so that they know that when the decision is made, everybody knows what facts the decision is going to be based on. However, today, a hearings officer who still works for an agency that's not part of the hearings officer panel has a much more limited requirement to disclose ex-party communications. We believe that the more extensive provisions on disclosure of ex-party communications should be applicable to all hearings officers. The ex-party disclosure provision should be uniform, whether a contested case is conducted by a hearing officer panel hearings officer or by a hearing officer who still is employed by the agency. And the more controversial one would be that we advocate extending the requirement for disclosing ex-party communications to those people who make ex-party communications to the ultimate decision-maker, who, in, as I said, in most cases, the agencies themselves, the agency head or the boards and commissions, retain to themselves the ability to ultimately make the final decision based on the hearing officer's proposed order. In some of those cases, they may have staff saying things to them. They are the ultimate judge. Something like, well, I think so-and-so is a drug-dealing scumbag. There's nothing on the record at all on that, but it may prejudice the final decision-maker. And again, the person against whom a decision might be rendered is unaware that that kind of information is being communicated to the final decision-maker. So we would extend the requirements for disclosure of ex-party contacts to those ex-party contacts that are made not only to the hearing officer, but also to the ultimate fact decision-maker, which could be the agency head or the board or commission. We just think that but the only requirement to disclose these would be if it relates to a factual or legal issue in the case. So that's important. Attorney-client communications would not be subject to this. They'd continue to be exempt from disclosure. We just want to ensure through these provisions that an agency's final decision on whether or not to impose a penalty or take other enforcement action against an individual or business is based only on the facts developed on the record during the hearing as required by law, and that off-the-record or ex-party communications need to be disclosed so all parties have a chance to refute or clarify the information communicated. Without disclosure, there's no effective check on agency staff improperly communicating information outside the hearing record. As we said, many agencies currently provide some of these protections that I've talked about. The administrative law section believes, however, that institutionalizing these best practices for all agency contested case hearings will promote trust in state government actions. There should be little or no cost to implement these reforms, but the cost to state agencies of handling contested cases without these fundamental protections include the incalculable loss of public confidence, and that's hard to get back when you lose it. And also, we think by instituting these best practices, the agencies will avoid taking bad cases to hearing or having bad cases have to go up on appeal, which is costly to everyone. We'd be happy to answer any questions or provide additional information to the committee.
Committee members, is there questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Shirley.
Is Janice going to testify, or is that your combined testimony?
I don't think we have anything to add except to say that the administrative law section very much supports the second step, 2526. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I think if I just respond to that, I think a lot of what we've heard from Diana is what I might maybe describe as the third step in the panel. It's hard for me to not be drafting amendments to address some of those issues. By the same token, as 2525 was a process of compromise and give and take among the interested parties, I think we've achieved the same in House Bill 2526. There is a comfort level with the elements that are in the bill.
Absolutely.
Among the bar and the governor's office with the amendment that we're looking at here today and the
right.
Department of Justice I think substantially the agencies. And so I think those are all good comments, and I think we may hear from the Department of Justice about how some of those are being addressed in even rule changes. And those are the very kinds of things that the Oversight Committee will continue to monitor along with the efficiencies and the other issues that were raised by the JLAC audit. And I think once we get the panel made permanent, take a look at some of those things
right.
for ongoing amendment into the future.
It's not our intention at all to slow down this bill, but
right.
to raise these issues for consideration. These are important issues.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I did do written testimony, too.
Okay. Oh, great. Our last two witnesses, Bill Schrail and Mary Botkin. I know you're not connected, but I thought I'd bring you up.
Mr. Chair, members
you both signed up in the four column, so I figured you wouldn't mind sitting at the table with each other.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and we represent many of the administrative law, the hearings officers, and have a contract with the hearings officer panel. We're actually here very much in favor of this bill. I've talked to some of the folks who do this work, and they only had one concern, and unlike OPEU, we did not sign off on the verbal agreement to the use of law clerks. We think that currently our administrator's great, but we also know that administrators don't last forever, and laws do. And we would like in the law, in the statute, and we can do it either here or if the committee would prefer, it's not our intention to slow the bill down. We could do it in the Senate, whichever works best for you. But we would like to insert some language that says that while they can use law clerks, they can't use them as hearings officers. And that would be the only change that we'd like to see in the bill. And we'd like to, as I said, you know, we like the current administrator. We trust him. But, you know, he could be gone tomorrow.
Sure. Okay, Representative Shetterly.
Well, actually, Mary, with the protections in the House Bill 2526 for termination, I'm not sure that he could be gone tomorrow.
Well, I mean, he may be by choice.
No, I understand. No,
you know, he may go on to do this in another state somewhere.
Mr. Chair, also in the interest of not slowing this down, I will commit to working with Mary and Mr. Ewing if the committee's interest is in working this today and putting it out. I have the feeling that there's... you are moving in the same direction here as the intent that Mr. Ewing expressed, and so if it takes some language, I'm happy to try and work that out between here and the Senate.
Absolutely. And I'm
some
and
level
I'm,
of comfort with whatever works for you and Mr. Ewing. I sure don't want to commit, but I will. We'll work it out.
And I am more than comfortable with that commitment from you, Representative Shetterly, and I'm reasonably sure that this can be resolved fairly easily. As I said, it's not an effort to slow down the bill by any means. Our folks are very happy with the way the system is working, and so.
Great.
Thank you. And I have another committee to go to unless you have questions.
Are there questions for Mary?
No, just I want to thank Mary for this because, you know, I know that 4 years ago there was some real angst among the OPU. And,
nicely put.
Yeah, ask me about the coming together of this panel. And I think it's remarkable that 4 years after the fact, we have sign-off from one of the unions and testimony from the other in support of the continuation of the
panel. I think everybody was very, very nervous about this, yeah. Representative Shetterly, and I think it has worked well. And I think it is a testament to the fact that everybody's worked real hard to make this work.
Okay.
And so... as I said, we have no interest in slowing the bill down, so we'll work with you to resolve these issues between here and the Senate.
Okay. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
And speaking of angst, Mr. Schrader.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, I'm assuming, Chair Williams, that my presence here doesn't give you angst. I'm hoping that you were thinking that I might have some.
Based on our prior conversations, Bill, but it's good to have you here.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2526 as well. As Representative Shetterly noted, and I think Tom Ewing noted as well, both Kelly Knievel and I, who are members of the Department of Justice, are participatory members of the Oversight Committee, and so the Oversight Committee recommendations came out of that process, and that is essentially what House Bill 2526 is. And before going any further, I would like to make the offer, to the extent that our office can be of any help, Representative Shetterly, in working through any issues that might come up about the law clerk question, feel free to call upon me personally or anybody in our department. We have a similar provision in our statute about the hiring of law clerks, authority to do that. And I do want to commend Representative Shetterly for his kind of considered and deliberate approach. The Department of Justice sees things from, I think, a unique and large perspective in that we see systems and we see the administrative law process on a wide range and over a wide range of activities. And I think it's that kind of background and that perspective that gives us, some pause at times and some concerns at times that I think need to be heeded because of the fact that changes to the administrative law practice do affect things system-wide. What House Bill 2526 does do is make permanent the hearing officer panel as currently constituted, and we think that's a good step. But when you consider whether there should be additional changes made, that's when perhaps angst comes into the picture to some extent. I also, before going into that angst, want to also commend Tom Ewing for relieving some angst. I think he has done a very, very fine job as the administrator of the hearing officer panel, and I think he's helped get it through its infancy into its current state that you see it before you now. And in fact, I mean, I think it has been a very, very overwhelming job to the extent that when created, the hearing officer panel in Oregon was the second largest in the nation. It now handles over 30,000 cases, and I think it still is approximately the second largest in the nation. that's kind of segues into a question or concern that we have on a forward-going basis. Currently, the agencies that are within the panel are almost all agencies. There are some agencies that have been exempted from the panel, and there are policy reasons behind those. Entities like the parole board, entities like statewide elected officials who conduct some contested case hearings. And consequently, you know, a concern that we would have would be further consider future consideration of additions to the agencies that are covered by the panel. And we'd certainly like to be very much a part of any discussions along those lines. And that kind of, again, segues into a second concern that I want to just raise for the committee members and then for the members of the Legislative Assembly. Currently, I think the resources of the hearing officer panel are strapped. They're as handling as many cases as they can. And it does give me a little bit of angst to hear Mr. Ewing suggest that, you know, there's the ability to have some reduction in hearing officers assigned to the panel. One of the concerns that we have expressed, and I think it has been adequately addressed to date, are the timeliness of the processing of these cases. I think it was Representative McPherson who asked the question about outcomes and quality of orders. With respect to quality of orders, I think the orders coming out of the hearing officer panel are improving. With respect to outcomes, we don't really pay attention to the outcomes in cases. What I worry about more is just on a systemic basis whether there will be adequate resources for Mr. Ewing and his colleagues to be able to process the cases that we're asking them to do. What I don't want to have happen is that we create an entity and then leave it as an orphan without having the resources necessary to process the cases. As I said, the bigger concern that we have is the overall time of the process to make sure that from the date of referral to the hearing officer panel to the date of conclusion of the proceeding, that those matters can be efficiently and effectively pushed through the system. Case in point would be unemployment insurance benefits cases. The question has been adequately addressed in the interim, but just so that you folks will know, both with the unemployment insurance benefits cases and with the Department of Human Services cases, there are federal law requirements that overlay those processes, and if they don't meet federal timelines, there can be, you know, onerous penalties, financial penalties at play. We're currently okay on those fronts, but I want to make sure that we don't have, you know, a system set up where we have an entity that is removed from those concerns in the sense of just processing cases without the administrative oversight. Right now it is housed within the employment department. I think that functionally works fine. If there were to be consideration to remove it and house it somewhere else, or to create it on its own independent standalone basis, again, the Department of Justice would like to be very much a part of that conversation because there are significant issues that revolve around those kinds of issues as well. To date, and I think that the excerpt from the Joint Legislative Audit Committee report that you have does show that they undertook, but only in a very kind of surface-limited way, kind of an efficiency or any kind of an audit of how the operation is being conducted. Again, I don't mean to question Tom Ewing's efforts and their efforts of the members of the panel. That is, they are doing a wonderful job. They are working very hard. I don't fault anyone. What I want to make sure of, though, again, is on a forward-going basis that we have adequate resources and staff for the hearing officer panel to do its job. So consequently, I really am a strong supporter of the Oversight Committee retaining its oversight function and the need for us to, you know, look statistically down the line to make sure that we are adequately funding and adequately providing resources for the committee. With those kinds of, you know, general concerns only on a forward-looking basis, you know, we support House Bill 2526. I want to briefly turn my attention to proposals that were a bit beyond what 2526's parameters are, and I'll only touch upon them very briefly. The concerns, I think, boil down to three or four. One of the concerns that was raised that the current system doesn't provide for enough control in the hearing officers for control over discovery. And we, the Department of Justice, has engaged already in a proposed rulemaking that goes well towards resolving many of those issues, if not nearly all of them. In fact, there is a hearing conducted today, a rulemaking hearing conducted today up in Portland. There will be a second hearing conducted very soon. And in those proposed rules, control over discovery is delegated in the first instance to hearings officers, as well as a significant more amount of control over the process and conduct of the administrative hearing itself. Some of the concerns that underlay discovery, however, are a way to ensure that confidentiality statutes that exist and costs associated with discovery can be adequately patrolled and adequately controlled. And consequently, if to try and enact statutes dealing with that, those two would have significant policy concerns that need to be very careful in how you go about setting those in stone through the statutory process. We think a much better approach is through rulemaking and engaged in that process, and I think that will go far towards resolving some of the concerns, if not all of the concerns that were raised. With respect to ex parte contacts, that is a particularly sensitive area that's a particular difficulty. Department of Justice, we are in the business of providing legal advice to our agencies. Ex parte contact provisions, as broadly as they are proposed in what used to or is House Bill 2058, are very problematic on two fronts. At least they demand that we assign potentially two AAGs, two assistant attorneys general, to every case, one who would handle the contested case proceeding, one who would handle advice to the final agency decision maker, as well as being overly broad in the sense that it would impinge upon our ability to provide legal advice at all that would not be, well, confidential legal advice to the final agency decision maker. So consequently, again, if there's any consideration of giving, you know, statutory provisions to touch upon ex parte contacts with respect to our office's ability to provide advice to final agency decision makers, that is fraught with a tremendous amount of difficulty, both in the sense of I don't think you want to have agencies out there unable to get legal advice, nor do I think you want to double the cost of providing that legal advice from our office to agencies. My final comments are, again, I want to commend the efforts that have gotten the hearing officer panel, and I think I'd almost like to segue into calling the Office of Administrative Hearings, the Office of Administrative Hearings, to the place where it is to date. It is a remarkable achievement to have, you know, created from the get-go a tremendously productive hearing officer office, and commend the approach of going a little bit slowly, because if you take off big chunks, there are unintended consequences that can devastate the system. To date, I think we're doing fine. With that, if anybody has any questions, I'd be more than happy to address them.
Are there questions for Mr. Schradl?
Just a comment. I think Phil's testimony probably gives you some flavor as to why we have the stripped-down version of this bill before us. Of course, with the sunset approaching, the overriding issue is making this permanent and repealing that sunset. And some of these issues, I think, are worth dealing with, but probably discreetly outside of the context of the bill that repeals the sunset, since that is the most critical. And I appreciate Phil's and the Department of Justice's willingness to keep that conversation going, as well as just a remark that I think some of the changes that are reflected in the new draft administrative rules also reflect probably a greater level of comfort with the role of the panel in the Department of Justice than there was in the beginning. And that's all to the good. Also, I share Phil's concerns, of course, about staffing of the panel and the effect that has on timeliness of decisions. Unfortunately, staffing levels are going to be a concern in every agency, and given the efficiencies that Mr. Ewing addressed in his testimony, we're probably getting more bang for our buck by consolidating these hearing officers where they can work on several agency cases than we would if we were to put these back out into the sending agencies the way they were before. So that's a ways and means issue, ultimately, in terms of how many dollars they give to employment to give to the hearing officer panel, but it's a real one, and I share it too.
Okay, Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I was kind of slow on SB 81 and finding any of the door prize
We're not on that bill any longer.
I know that. But I heard Representative Shetterly use the word angst, hastily went through 25, 26, didn't see it anywhere. I was wondering if he could give us the page.
Irrational fear.
All right. Are there any further questions? We could have had this hearing with just Representative Shetterly here, I think. I think it's important for the committee to understand the important transition that we've gone through since 1997 till now, with a process that will continue to be, I think, a work in process as it moves forward. Anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2526? Hearing no takers, we will close the public hearing and we will open a work session on House Bill 2526.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2526.
Representative Shetterly moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2526. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Just before I move the bill, it looks like we, I want to put on the record the conversation I had with Marsha Ohlmiller here from Boley. She had requested, and I think we both thought the other might, or somehow this amendment might be coming up today. So on the record, I will say that we'll be working with an amendment on the Senate side that's very easy. Boley wanted a clarification that the Wage and Hour Commission and Apprenticeship and Training Council are excluded. As I understand, they've not been regarded as included. Boley is an agency that comes under the exclusion in House Bill 2525, and as I understand, Wage and Hour and Apprenticeship Training Council cases have not been under the purview of the hearing officer panel. They requested a clarifying amendment to state that explicitly, and I will work with the panel and Boley to make sure that amendment gets in on the Senate side.
Okay, good enough.
And, Mr. Chair, with that...
Representative Shetterly, my recollection is that this bill originally came to us with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We received a notice from the Legislative Fiscal Office that it has minimal expenditure impact, and my recollection is that we were authorized by the Speaker's Office to rescind the subsequent referral.
That's my recollection. So that would be my motion to pass House Bill 2526 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Shetterly moves that we pass House Bill 2526 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that we rescind the subsequent referral of the bill to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not real sure how a non-attorney sitting on a judiciary panel committee, having listened to glowing accolades about the bill and the policy, should approach the reservations that I have. I seem to once again kind of feel like that blindfolded man out on a limb with a saw in his hand, not sure what side to start cutting on.
Always cut on Representative Barker's side. Representative
Barker. Thank you, Chair William. I've heard here no opposition. I've heard no abuse. But to me, I see significant potential for abuse. An agency of the state has a tremendous advantage when they go one-on-one with one of my constituents. The constituent frequently may be less than well educated. The people in the agency are going to be, for the most part, professional level education. The people in the agency will have the advantage of legal counsel through the agency if they don't have their own lawyers involved. And as a consequence, now we come up with a we have a law we have in front of us that we've had some admissions of some shortcomings, and the I do appreciate that Justice Department is willing to work on rules on some of those issues. The discovery issue is, you know, one of those. I understand now why the constituent cases that I've had that have dealt with this process, the constituents are less than enthusiastic. I may have a limited and perhaps even biased sample of that. Having said this, Mr. Chair, I recognize that this is a probably a giant step forward as far as trying to get resolution and hopefully honest resolution to issues that appear or problems that appear. I guess I would like to conclude by saying that I will support the bill, but I'll certainly be watching for the changes that have been talked about and proposed today to see whether they are, in fact, somewhere in the not too distant future put in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jensen, and I'm sure Representative Shirley may want to also offer a bit of a response. I'll just give you, not having been as closely involved in the details of this as Representative Shirley has, but I'll harken back to 1995, which was my first involvement with the subject matter generally, and it was the session when the legislature chose to remove the hearings officers out of the Department of Revenue in tax matters and to create the Tax Magistrate Division as a subset of the tax court. And it was the first step, I think, perhaps in a test almost, of trying to move the decision makers in these hearings processes out of the agencies where they were a bit more under the control of the agency management, and to get us to a more independent decision-making body on the that could fairly represent the taxpayer or the citizen who was brought before that agency. And I think it's been an important step, and I think we heard yesterday when we had lunch with the court that even though they had a certain amount of angst when that happened, I think it's been viewed as a substantial positive movement in that area. And I think the hearings officer panel approach was sort of born out of that discussion. And I think what you're seeing, Representative Jensen, is a general acknowledgement by the legislature in general that there is a fairness issue associated with getting independent resolution of these matters, where it doesn't only have the appearance of being fair, but the actual tools of being fair. And I think you're seeing that movement take place. And I think 2525 was the first step to that. I think 2526 furthers that movement. And I think that that movement will continue over time. But it is a substantial change in the approach that we've taken with administrative law in Oregon, and I think it's one that you have to watch evolve over a period of time. That would be my response to the concerns that you have about this process, and at least my short comment on how I view it. To Representative Shetterly, if you'd
like. Yeah, no, thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jensen, Representative Jensen, I think your comments and your constituents' concerns really reflect what the impetus was in the creation of the panel in the first place, that very concern that the agencies had the ability to not only control the prosecution but the outcome as well, because of the inside nature and the way these hearings were conducted. House Bill 2525 4 years ago moved us a huge step in the direction toward fairness in appearance and in fact as well. Of course, this bill makes another step further in that direction by making it permanent. And I think with that, there will come even a strengthening of the mission of the panel. Now that it becomes a permanent aspect of state government, I think it will strengthen the role and function of the panel in providing just the kind of protections from abuse that you're concerned about. You may be of the mind with Ms. Godwin and Ms. Krem that this bill could go further, and it may very well, or not this bill, but another bill may, if not this session, then the session down. But down the road, but I think incrementally we're moving in exactly the direction that your concerns would dictate.
If I could, and I do appreciate that, but I still have to express my concerns.
Yeah, and we appreciate you putting them on the record, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, in response to Representative Jensen, I have heard similar complaints both as a lawyer and as a legislator. But I think there's a distinction between a constituent or a client that is railing at a bad decision of the agency, and these usually come with respect to increasing child support, suspending driver's licenses, or denying unemployment compensation. That's, I think, the bulk of the constituents that I hear from. But there's a difference between saying I'm dissatisfied with the agency decision and saying I did not get a fair hearing. Many of the people that come to me and rail at agency decisions have not requested a hearing. Therefore, I think don't really reflect the favorable or disfavorable treatment of the concept of a hearings panel. I have found that even when constituents represent themselves before agencies, I find in many instances the forms are pre-prepared by the agency to request that hearing or to file that petition in the areas I've mentioned. It's been my experience in hearings with parties that are unrepresented by counsel that they are treated with the with discretion and with professionalism by the hearings officers. So I just want to bring that distinction up. You really have to find out whether your constituent is just dissatisfied with the decision or they're dissatisfied with the hearing process that led to this decision. I think that's a significant distinction.
Thank you. Other comments? Well, that was, I think, an instructive dialogue for the committee to have, and I'll remind the committee of the motion that's now pending, which is to refer House Bill 2526 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a rescission of the referral of the bill to the Ways and Means Committee. So why don't we go ahead and call the roll, Ann?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Excused.
Representative Pearson?
Aye.
Representative Pozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2526 is amended and moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the Ways and Means referral is rescinded. And with that, colleagues, we are... Oh, Perrier. Yeah. Bob, do you want this? No. Representative Shetterly will be assigned as the carrier.
Bad bill.